This podcast was recorded on Thursday, July 26th at 10:33 a.m. Things might have changed by the time you hear it.
Yeah, like maybe this year, Governor Kasich will decide to resume the tradition of spending a night in the sheep barn at the Ohio State Fair.
Do you think they can patch him into CNN from there? Either way, let's talk Ohio politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those snollygosters with their bland talking points who make the laws in the statehouse. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, can Tim Ryan ride the magic yoga mat to the White House?
But first, we are a little more than a week away from the latest blue wave bellwether election, and it's right here in Ohio. On August 7th, voters decide the 12th Congressional District special election. It's Pat Tiberi's old seat here in central Ohio. He left office last winter. Republican State Senator Troy Balderson of Zanesville faces Democratic Franklin County Recorder Danny O'Connor.
This week, O'Connor had an awkward moment when he went on MSNBC's Hardball and faced Chris Matthews, who wanted to know who O'Connor's choice for Speaker of the House would be should the Democrats take control of the House.
Okay, what about Nancy Pelosi? The first vote you have to cast when you become a member of Congress is to vote for the leader of your party that's nominated for Speaker. Who are you going to vote for Speaker?
I don't know who's going to run, but I know
Pelosi's running for re-election.
We need change.
So.
We need change on both sides.
So you're not voting for Pelosi?
No.
Well, how are you going to help the Democrats get the 218 they need to win the House? You have to be one of the votes.
Yeah, we
so what are you going to do? If you're one of the 218 they need to take control of the House, and the vote on the floor is Pelosi, what are you going to do?
We need to have new leadership on both sides.
So you'd vote against her even if it meant you didn't get control of the House?
We need leadership
on both
sides.
And you don't get control of the House?
Well, we need to
if it's a decisive vote, would you vote against Pelosi? If it's decisive.
We need new leadership
on both
sides.
You know you have to decide this. Just tell me you know you have to decide it.
No, but we need new leadership.
No, just tell me you know.
The old ways aren't working.
No. You know that for the Democrats to get control, you have to have 218 members of the House
absolutely
vote for the candidate of the Democratic Party for Speaker.
Can I would you support do that? Whoever the Democratic Party
thank
puts
you
forward.
Well, Republicans pounced, saying O'Connor has flip-flopped by saying he would support whoever the Democrats put forward means that he would support Nancy Pelosi. It's a bit of a stretch. O'Connor basically said he would vote for Pelosi if it was between her and a Republican. But O'Connor's opponents were up with an ad in a matter of hours. O'Connor's camp immediately responded with an ad of their own.
So that aside, this race remains very close, so close that political analyst Kyle Condick has moved the 12th from leaning Republican to toss-up. This is big news in pundit world because this district is traditionally safe for Republicans. Joining us now to explain the change in rating is Kyle Condick. He's the managing editor at Sabatow's Crystal Ball, published by the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Kyle, welcome to Snollygoster.
Thanks for having me.
Why switch it from leaning Republican to a toss-up?
Troy Balderson has led, I think, basically every poll that I'm aware of in this district by varying margins, and yet there are certain indicators that I think have been pretty decent for O'Connor and not so great for Balderson. Part of it is some of the early voting and absentee statistics, which have been lopsidedly Democratic in a district that otherwise you would expect it to sort of be a little bit more Republican-leaning. Now, granted, those statistics can sometimes be Democratic-leaning, and we'll have to see where that ends up by the time the early voting absentee period is over, but also the fact that the some of the Democratic outside groups, particularly the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which I don't think was particularly hot on this race as of a month or so ago, they've decided to invest, so they must be seeing something that they like. Republican outside groups continue to pour money into the district. Not necessarily at the level we've seen in some of the other closely watched House special elections so far this cycle, but at a significant enough rate that they seem to still be concerned that this is a losable race for them. And also, what we've seen in special elections across the country this year is that Democratic candidates are routinely running ahead of Hillary Clinton's 2016 performance in the handful of federal special elections that we've had, and then in the larger universe of state legislative special elections. And Trump won this district by about 11 points, If you just sort of take the average change that we've seen in these special elections and apply it to Ohio 12, you basically are looking at kind of a 50-50 race. Probably at the end of the day, would still rather be the Republican in a district like this. But I think it's gotten close enough that I just didn't feel comfortable having him, you know, having him as Alderson as a favorite in our ratings anymore. So that's why I made the change.
Kyle Condick is with us here on Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media. Kyle, some experts say this is the biggest special election since Democrat Connor Lamb won a traditionally Republican seat in Pennsylvania. Do you see a lot of similarities between these two special elections?
Yeah, there are some similarities. I think that is probably true. And, of course, we've had some other big special elections at the federal level so far this cycle. Georgia's 6th District, which is suburban Atlanta, which was decided last summer in a runoff that the Republican won narrowly, that ended up being basically the most expensive House race in U.S. history. And also we had a special Senate election in Alabama where Democrat Doug Jones actually won in what was a pretty considerable upset over Republican Roy Moore, who I have to say is arguably the worst candidate I've ever seen, but you have to be a terrible Republican candidate to lose statewide in Alabama these days. But as for Ohio 12 and comparing it to Pennsylvania 18, if in fact Annie O'Connor wins the race, the pattern of electoral support will be similar to PA18 in that just like PA18, Ohio 12 is a suburban district with some kind of bigger rural counties attached to it. If O'Connor wins, it'll be because the Franklin County parts of the district turn out at a disproportionately high rate and vote for him at a disproportionately high rate. And that's certainly possible. And again, that sort of pattern with the places closest to the central city in question, Columbus in this case, Pittsburgh in the case of PA18, there would be some commonalities there if, in fact, O'Connor wins, or even if O'Connor, comes within a few points of winning but falls short.
This is a unique case because there's an August 7th special election that will fill out the Pat Tiberi's term through the end of this year. Then there's another election in November where the same candidates face off again, and the winner of that has the seat for the 2 years following this year. Which race do you think is more of a toss-up? How do you differentiate between the two?
Yeah, I do think we have to sort of take them one at a time. I think that if Alderson wins the special election, he probably becomes a favorite in the fall. If O'Connor wins, I'm a little less sure. Maybe it's more of a toss-up. I do think there's sort of a limited form of incumbency that the winner would get. And also just having the shine of being the victor, which of course would get a ton of coverage in the Columbus media market. Just a few months before the so-called real election for the full term, I have to sort of reassess it, after we get the results, and then to sort of move from there. I will say though that in a neutral environment, this is not a district that a Democrat should be able to win, in my estimation. But it speaks to the Democratic leaning midterm environment that we're in. That we're talking about this race as basically a 50-50 kind of race, or rather a race where it's hard to know at this point who the victor is going to be, in my opinion.
Yeah, the margin of victory in August will help us gauge how November is going to go, I would guess. You've also moved Congressman Steve Chabot's race in the Cincinnati area from lean Republican to toss-up. Chabot faces Democrat Aftab Pureval. What's going on there?
Pureval's become, I think, is a pretty formidable candidate, and Chabot has been in Congress. He got elected. He was part of the class of 1994, when, of course, the Republicans took control of the U.S. House for the first time in what was then, four decades, the early 1950s. And Chabot has been in the House ever since then, except he lost in 2008 and then won the seat back in 2010. The district lines changed after the 2010 census, and the district became a little bit more Republican, but the district that Donald Trump won by about half a dozen points. But it does have some similarities to Ohio 12 in that it is sort of connected to a big city, Cincinnati in the case of Ohio 1, Columbus, of course, in the case of Ohio 12. It is also a more affluent district than the national average, and also is a more highly educated district than the national average. And that can be an indication of kind of disenchantment with the president, given that the big split we saw, or the big difference we saw in the 2016 presidential election compared to previous elections, was that white college-educated voters swung toward Clinton, and white non-college-educated voters swung toward Trump. And, you know, Pureval has routinely been out raising Steve Chabot. He's getting close to Chabot in terms of, you know, cash on hand for his campaign. And I think there are some Republicans concerned that Chabot maybe isn't taking the race as seriously as he needs to be. But at the same time, you know, Ohio 12 and Ohio 1 are districts that are definitely designed to elect Republicans and generally would elect Republicans in a normal year, but this is not a normal kind of year. You know, this is probably going to be a Democratic-leaning year to at least some extent. So we'll see if the Republican map and these Republican candidates hold up under what should be some considerable strain from the national environment and also from good challengers.
Kyle Condick is the managing editor of Sabatow's Crystal Ball, published by the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. We've been talking about congressional races here in Ohio. Kyle Condick, thanks for joining Snollygoster.
Thank you.
In the race for governor, Democrat Richard Cordray this week picked up the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police of Ohio. The FOP really does not like Mike DeWine. He's the state's top law enforcement officer, someone who tries to portray himself as tough on crime.
But the FOP did not endorse the Republican DeWine in 2010 when he ran against and beat Cordray. Then in 2014, the FOP endorsed Democrat David Pepper over DeWine. Mike, what gives?
I think there's some, you know, small stuff going on as far as support for police vests and equipment and things like that the FOP holds against Mike DeWine. And this is the leadership of the FOP, not the rank and file. As you mentioned, you know, the FOP did not endorse DeWine in 2010, and he still won. Mm-hmm. So how much this endorsement means, we don't know. My guess is that the rank and file is at least divided between Cordray and DeWine, if not, maybe perhaps favors the Republican a little bit more.
Yeah, and as we know, unions typically go with the liberal in the race. Not always, but this year, six out of the seven seats are being the FOP is endorsing a Democrat running for statewide office. The equipment issue you mentioned, that is pretty minor. I think DeWine, some state agents with the BCI were using expired bulletproof vests. They're now coming in. They're ordering new ones, and they're supposed to all have them pretty soon. They might have them all new with new vests already. But yeah, this is a years long thing, it seems like, with DeWine. I don't know how much it affects the race, honestly.
I think right to work is out there. I think that the unions are, you know, they're worried about right to work legislation. Of course, the Supreme Court said that fair share payments by public employee unions are unconstitutional if they're mandated. So that issue is out there. I think DeWine, you know, has said that it's not on his agenda, but it's not a strong opposition to right to work legislation. I think just think that the unions tend to go for Democrats, and I think occasionally police unions go for Republicans, but this case, they stuck with the Democrat.
Which is strange, because this is anecdotal. Every police officer I know is a Republican.
That's what I mean. The rank-and-file police officers often do not line up with leadership.
Yeah, they're obviously like their union, they like their pension, but they are personally, at least in my experience, they tend to be more conservative.
The exception was Senate Bill 5, when the Republicans
when their
the state house.
When their pensions could have been threatened,
yes.
when their collective bargaining power could have been threatened.
Every union marched on the state house against Republicans then.
Staying with the two candidates for governor, still a lot of talk about health care in the race. Richard Cordray this week unveiled his health care plan. Not a lot of surprises there. He continued his support for Medicaid expansion and offering incentives for programs designed to boost access to preventative health care, particularly for underserved and low-income Ohioans. Still not a lot of details, though.
It was, you know, basically status quo, continue the program that John Kasich began, continue Obamacare, strong support for Obamacare, what's left of the provisions that are there. Mike DeWine continues to take some heat for his clarification on his stance on Medicaid expansion. Last week he said he would continue it but improve it. PolitiFact Ohio called that a full flip-flop, but DeWine says his position has not changed.
He was one of the attorneys general who sued to block the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, is what enabled Medicaid to be expanded. He technically did not sue to block Medicaid expansion. He sued to block the whole ACA.
Yeah.
So he's, I don't want to say he's lying, but he certainly it's not a true representation of how he's acted since he was Attorney General.
Yeah, I mean, he's riding the fence, which is probably a smart thing to do because polls show that health care is the number one issue out there right now.
We know Governor John Kasich is running for something, president, cable TV host, maybe Genoa Township trustee, something, we just don't know what.
There is lots of talk that Sherrod Brown might run for president if he wins re-election this year. And now another Ohioan is drawing a smidge, just a smidge, of presidential speculation. Congressman Tim Ryan of the Youngstown area.
Who? We know Tim Ryan. I don't know. I don't think anybody in California knows Tim Ryan.
Nancy Pelosi from California knows who Tim Ryan
is. That was a bad analogy. The Intercept, the online publication, is the latest to say Ryan is considering running for president. He's got some blue collar Democratic credentials. He's from Northeast Ohio, from the Youngstown area. He kind of represents a new generation of Democratic leader, if you will, and he is mindful.
Yes, mindful. The Intercept says Ryan has told friends he can win the White House by winning the yoga vote. Ryan, of course, this is true. He's a big believer in mindfulness. He's written a book on mindfulness. He's a big believer in yoga and meditation. So I guess the yoga vote is the new soccer mom vote. Is that what that is?
I was confused by this because I took it literally. And I'm with you. I think he mainly means suburban middle-aged women.
Yes. And those are the folks who are turned off by Donald Trump, so he can capture them and also capture some of the blue-collar folks in the Youngstown area who very much like him. He wins easily in a favorable district for him, for Democrats. But he's done a few things. He's traveled to New Hampshire, South Carolina. He bought some voter research in Iowa. He did get a smidge, to use that word again, of national attention when he took on Nancy Pelosi for House Speaker.
And failed.
Yes. no surprise there. But he got a little bit of attention there. So it's to say it's a long shot would be an understatement. It's hard for a member of Congress to go directly from the House to the White House.
How often does that happen?
I think it hasn't happened in over a century. And just the simple math, you need roughly 220,000 to 250,000 votes to win your seat in Congress. You need 63 million votes to win the White House. So you just do not have the political base from Congress to run for president, unless maybe you're a Speaker of the House, and that doesn't even happen. So
yeah, I mean, Paul Ryan, I mean, he's as well known as a member of the House as there is, and I don't think he would be any kind of shoe-in to win the Republican nomination for president. And again, Nancy Pelosi knows him, but I don't think he can buy all the research he wants. Who knows him outside of Ohio who's not in Congress, who's not a politico?
Yeah, so there was some speculation in that Intercept that he is doing this just to boost his name recognition for two things. One, he could possibly be named to the cabinet of a Democratic president if he or she wins in 2020. And, you know, John Kasich did this. He ran directly from the House. Now, he was Budget Committee chairman, so he had a higher profile position. But he ran from the House for president, failed, but it boosted his name recognition, fundraising ability, which you could argue led to his successful campaign for governor.
And Tim Ryan, he might have had something up his sleeve when we were all, at least a lot of people were mildly surprised when he did not decide to run for governor.
Yeah, that's one of the doubters. So he always has speculated for a higher office and never runs for it.
It's time now for our weekly search for John Kasich. We'll call this the State Fair edition of John Kasich GPS.
Governor Kasich, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thanks, Chuck.
Governor, welcome back to Fox News Sunday.
We went to Tulsa instead of where we were going in Colorado.
I think I've eaten my way across the entire state of New York.
Ground control to major.
For the final time, one final time, the governor opened the Ohio State Fair this week. And what do you do at the state fair if you're a moderate Republican? You take a swipe at Donald Trump and his bailout of tariff-plagued farmers.
The access to those markets are critical to a farmer. They want to sell. They don't want to be subsidized. They don't want to be put on welfare. They want to be in a position of where they can sell their products around the world.
Mike, did you see what the governor was wearing during that? He was wearing the preppiest clothes you could imagine. It was the farthest from Bob Taft's cowboy hat that you could ever imagine.
Bob Taft, I think, loved the fair. Bob Taft continued Governor Rhodes' tradition of sleeping in the sheep barn or the dairy barn. Bob Taft, when I covered Bob Taft at the opening of the state fair one year, he had tears in his eyes. He and his wife had tears in his eyes when he opened the fair. The fair was close to his heart. I think John Kasich loves the fair. He loves the rides. The classic picture of him riding the slide with his daughters. He's an Ohio guy. He likes the fair, but I don't think he lives and breathes the fair. And he refuses to sleep in the sheep barn at the fair, as Governor Rhodes did and Bob Taft did and Governor Voinovich did. And
did Ted Strickland sleep in the, at the fair?
I believe he did. I think all the governors have spent a night in the barn.
Is John Kasich too good for the fair? What's he doing?
He doesn't want, you know, he doesn't want the late night TV.
He's getting
jokes.
All these Marriotts. Is he Marriotts or whatever, wherever he's standing, as he jets around the country? He's too good for the fair now.
Yeah. Maybe if he runs for president and wins, he can resume the tradition.
Oh, that'll be his return home. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster. Be sure to tell your friends about us. Also, leave us a good review on iTunes. And until next week, I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster on WOSU Public Media.
Our state fair is a great state fair. Don't miss it. Don't even delay. It's dollars to donuts that our state fair is the best state fair in our state.